From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Miles Parks in Washington, D.C. It's here and now. On a day when millions of Americans are experiencing more sweltering heat, President Biden is in Massachusetts to announce new actions to address climate change. He's visiting that state's last coal-fired power plant, which was shut down 5 years ago and is now being converted to supply underwater cables for offshore wind. Biden will talk up these kinds of clean energy transitions. But the White House says don't expect him to declare climate change a national emergency today, even though that's an action that many Democrats have been clamoring for. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is now with us to tell us more. Hey, Franco.
Hey, Miles.
So the White House says declaring a climate emergency is still on the table in the future, but Biden won't do it today. What would declaring an emergency like that mean, and why did he choose not to do this today?
I mean, what it would do is allow him to use some presidential powers to put more restrictions on fossil fuels. He could put a stop to oil drilling, for example, and he could ramp up clean energy projects like wind and solar and things like he's talking about today. The White House says that an emergency declaration, though, is not off the table, but there are reported concerns that the president does not want to further antagonize Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who has largely stood in the way of Biden's climate agenda. You know, they think he might be still be able to agree to some smaller measures.
Yeah, how is the White House feeling about Manchin these days? Are they still holding out hope that he will kind of come back to the table on some of these climate negotiations that he walked away from last week?
Not very much. You know, they don't want to antagonize him. They really hope that he might agree to things like clean energy tax credits on wind and solar. But, you know, the White House has also made very clear that it's taking these steps because Congress won't act. And Manchin has repeatedly derailed the administration's climate agenda, you know, causing quite a bit of frustration across the administration, including at the White House. And Democrats and activists are really pushing the president to be more bold and to take bigger steps on his own.
Okay, so what kind of climate actions will the president announce today if he's not going to make this executive order on declaring climate change a national emergency?
Well, he's going to take some action against, you know, that sweltering heat, the kind that you were talking about earlier, you know, as well as energy bills. He plans to announce additional funding for a FEMA program that assists local communities facing extreme heat. He's going to issue some guidance on supporting a Department of Health and Human Services program that helps families with energy costs. And he's also expected to take some steps to boost the offshore wind industry. You know, the plant he's visiting today, like you said, makes undersea cables that will bring power from wind turbines in the Atlantic Ocean to the electric grid. So he wants to promote that.
And Franco, while we have you, I want to ask you about the latest NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll that was just released. It has Biden's approval rating at 36%, which, you know, is the lowest that I believe that we've seen it hit so far, and that's due largely to a drop in support among Democrats. Can you talk a little bit about this new result and what it means for Democrats heading into the midterms?
Yeah, it's really not good. You know, and being that it's largely due to Democrats, you know, while 75% of Democrats approve of the job Biden is doing, that's really low for a president's own party. It was never that low, according to the poll for Trump, for example, including after the January 6th riots. And it's also, in today's poll, it's a 9-point drop among Democrats from last month. In addition to the, you know, falling support among Democrats, Biden is also hurting among young voters. Just 5% of young voters say they strongly approve of the job he's doing, and that's on par with a lot of Republican voters. And you mentioned the midterms, you know, it's clearly not a good sign for Democrats, but, you know, congressional Democrats do appear to be outpacing Biden's numbers. They expect to lose the House, Democrats that is, and they are very much in danger of losing the Senate as well. But they're hoping to kind of stem the damage by painting Republicans in the extreme. And one example right now that's animating Democrats is the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade. So really a lot to watch for.
Franco Ordonez is NPR's White House correspondent. Franco, thank you so much.
Thank you, Miles.
Last year alone, the pandemic killed more than 400,000 people in the U.S. and stressed the healthcare system to the point of near collapse. In that same period of time, healthcare CEOs took home billions of dollars in compensation. A new investigation by our editorial partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication, makes clear just how much they made. And consider this, the amount the top earner made would be enough to buy 99 private jets. STAT reporter Bob Herman worked on this story. Bob, hi.
Hi, Peter. Thanks.
So top of the list is Regeneron's Leonard Schleifer. His take-home pay was $453 million last year, almost half $1 billion. Tell me about him and why he represents such an extraordinary case.
He's one of the founders of Regeneron, which is a very large drug company famous for actually a COVID drug. So he's one of the founders, been there a long time. So he just owns a lot of stock in Regeneron. And over the course of the pandemic, the stock price of this company has done very well. So it just kind of makes sense that his pay increased lockstep with it.
He was the top earner in a group of CEOs that made $4.5 billion. Meanwhile, the median U.S. household income is about $67,000 a year. And many Americans are going bankrupt because of medical debt. So put those CEO earnings into some context for us.
You have a healthcare system that, by most public opinion polls, is not viewed favorably by the U.S. public. And then here you have, you know, 300 CEOs of the largest publicly traded healthcare companies making an average of $15 million each, and many earning much more than that. And then at the same time, you have millions of Americans who are going into medical debt. You have millions of families struggling through the pandemic, both health-wise and financially, and especially now in light of inflation and everything else, just a lot of families that are struggling in general. So it's just a stark contrast between a healthcare system that is very rich for those who kind of run it, but then the patients who receive the care and those who pay for the care, the public, taxpayers at large, nobody really thinks it's that great of a system. So it's a really stark contrast.
You were also able to figure out how many women were making that kind of money at these healthcare companies. What'd you find out?
Women have not been CEOs of healthcare companies. That's kind of been like a long-standing theme. And in this case, not only do they not occupy that corner office as much, they just didn't make as much either. Women made up less than 10% of the CEOs that we analyzed.
I want to go back to something you said at the beginning about Regeneron had created one of the treatments for COVID-19. So to be fair to these companies working in the pandemic, I'm sure a lot of them were trying to save people's lives with the work they were doing. So how do we account for that?
It's one of those things where I don't think anyone believes that nobody shouldn't be paid while working in healthcare. And with Regeneron, obviously, it had a monoclonal antibody, a drug that worked well against some of the initial strains of the coronavirus. It doesn't work anymore. But at the same time, a lot of these drugs and procedures and therapeutics were developed in part through the government and taxpayers. So that has to be taken into consideration as well. So the pandemic was just this weird instance where obviously the healthcare system, everyone kind of dug in and said, hey, we have to take care of people. We have to come up with a way to beat this back. But this analysis is a reminder, again, that the incentives really haven't changed, even with the pandemic here. And those incentives derive all of this. 80%, more than 80% of all these executives' pay came in the form of stock. So if that much of your pay is coming in the form of stock, you're going to do the things that will increase the stock price. That means sell more drugs, perform more procedures, raise more prices, open more hospitals and facilities and outpatient centers. And that's a lot of experts have said that's not necessarily the best way to be running a healthcare system.
So in other words, the compensation packages, as large as they are, would be a disincentive to change. I mean, why change anything about the healthcare system if it means you might not make as much money? Is that what you're getting at?
If the current system is incentivizing you to do more, that's not going to change. And when you have that much of your pay tied to a stock price, the stock prices increase based on future profitability, and future profitability rests on gaining more revenue, increasing sales, doing more things. So it's also a great, you know, representation of why it's so hard for things to change in the healthcare system. You see that right now in Congress, where they're kind of fighting even to make over small changes to drug pricing. Healthcare is so hard to change, even though there's a lot wrong with it. And these incentives are kind of a great representation of that.
What do the companies say when you ask them about this?
the usual fare of not being happy or wanting their pay to be represented in a different way. So what we did is we calculated stock a little bit differently. All these numbers are still in companies' filings, but we calculated them differently to kind of show the actual realized gains of someone's stock. Normally, the companies just report the estimated fair value, what the stock might look like at a point in time. But we look at it as, what does your stock look like over time? Obviously, stock values increase, so we wanted to reflect that. And these more reflective pay packages often show that CEOs make much more than companies tend to promote or are in the headlines.
Bob Herman is a reporter covering the business of healthcare with our editorial partners at Stat News. We'll link you to his report, which will show what top CEOs, healthcare CEOs, are making in the United States. Bob, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your vote is secret, but the fact that you voted in an election is typically a public record. So now, some people who falsely believe that the 2020 election was stolen are trying to audit the results themselves by going door to door in neighborhoods all across the country. This story took me to Colorado, where I reported on this sort of citizen oversight with Colorado Public Radio's Benta Berkland. Benta found a woman named Michelle Garcia, who was visited by two canvassers last year.
One had a clipboard and a baseball cap on. The other wore a blue-collared shirt and a lanyard.
They wanted to know how she cast her ballot. Here's a snippet of their interaction, recorded by Garcia's front door camera. You can hear them say they're working to verify the 2020 election results.
We're doing a voter verification project.
Okay.
We're working on the city voter rolls. We wanted to ask a couple of questions about the 2020 vote.
Okay.
Garcia, who lives in Pueblo County, Colorado, says the two men asked her all sorts of questions, all pointing back to the baseless idea that the 2020 election was stolen.
His specific questions were, did you vote by mail-in ballot? How many times have you voted? He wanted to know who I voted for, who I supported. How do I know that it wasn't changed? And a lot of it was targeted at the clerk and recorder's office and that it was fraudulent.
She told them she'd never had any issue with voting and didn't want to discuss her personal voting record.
They were very aggressive. There was no boundaries with their ethics or with civility. They will push until you give an answer.
A few hundred miles west in Mesa County, Ann Lamman was cooking dinner when three women knocked on her door.
They just said they were canvassing, surveying, and asked if I voted in the last election. And I said, yes. And they said, did your husband vote in the last election? And I said, yes, he did. And they said, okay, thank you very much.
She says the women weren't aggressive, but she still wondered why they were at her door.
I asked them as they were turning to leave, I said, who is this for? And they said, the Election Integrity Project, which I hadn't heard of.
Technically, the group is called the U.S. Election Integrity Plan, which, to be clear, is not affiliated with the U.S. government or any elections office. The group's training documents also say they wanted canvassers to be unbiased and to only verify publicly available data.
We've heard that many people welcome the canvassers trying to uncover voter fraud. But after her interaction, Landman, who's a Democratic activist, says she was annoyed when she read about the group's motivations. It's not clear if these canvassers were affiliated with the ones who came to Michelle Garcia's door, who said they were with a local group.
We should point out that in the 2 years since the 2020 election, numerous paper ballot hand counts, audits, and court cases across the country have confirmed the election results. But a constellation of these sorts of groups, where regular people go out in their neighborhoods and try to find the fraud themselves, have popped up across the country since 2020.
When the puzzle pieces don't fit together, it makes you wonder. And if it's important to you, you'll look into it.
That's Rebecca Kelty. She was a Republican congressional candidate. And we met up with her at an apartment building in El Paso County, where she helped canvass last summer. Kelty says canvassers were given sheets of voting records that included a person's name, address, and method of voting, all public information in Colorado, though it's not clear why they were sent to certain locations and neighborhoods and not others.
I'm not quite sure the criteria that they used to say, okay, these votes were in question, but they were in question.
No one knows exactly how common this sort of fraud-motivated canvassing has become around the country. The group in Colorado put out a report this spring indicating volunteers with the organization knocked on close to 10,000 doors in just four counties here. And officials in other Colorado counties and a number of other states say it's happening there too.
The 2020 election wasn't close in Colorado. Still, the state has become a hotbed for election misinformation. Most Colorado counties use voting systems from Dominion, which has become a target of right-wing conspiracies and is headquartered in Denver. Another example, Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters, who was indicted for allegedly tampering with election equipment in an effort to expose fraud. She's defended her actions.
Then there's Sean Smith, the co-founder of the Election Integrity Plan. He's from El Paso County. Recently, he said election officials, who he claims rigged the 2020 election, deserve to hang.
I think if you're involved in election fraud, then you deserve to hang. Sometimes the old ways are the best ways. I was accused of endorsing violence. I'm not endorsing violence. I'm saying when you put your hand on a hot stove, you get burned.
Smith's group, the Election Integrity Plan, did not respond to requests by NPR for comment. But the group's website makes it clear they're working on building a fraud-finding infrastructure. The group has published an organizing playbook so regular people everywhere can join the movement. Kelty, the canvasser we heard from earlier, said she wants there to be more scrutiny on the upcoming November election than ever before.
I hope it's under the tightest microscope you can possibly put it under.
Is there a part of you that worries about... There's a lot of election workers who are quitting right now because the pressure is just so great and they're like worried about their safety because they're getting threats in a way they never were before. Do you worry about that microscope kind of furthering that problem?
No, I don't think so. I think if there is pressure and if there are threats, then that right there tells you that something, they're trying to get away with something.
And to be clear, election officials in Colorado are feeling that strain. Like outgoing Republican clerk and recorder Chuck Broerman from El Paso County. He faced pushback from people who wanted to investigate the county's voting machines.
I remember after one particular meeting where there was a lot of pressure and the statement that, you know, Clerk Broerman will either do this with you or through you, which I took as a threat, that you better work with us or we'll make things difficult for you.
People associated with this canvassing movement say it's all about transparency. Here's Kelty.
You only hide things when you're ashamed of them. So let's go out. Let's open everything up. Complete transparency.
But the Election Integrity Plan isn't being fully transparent themselves. It claims to have affidavits indicating election crimes were committed in a number of Colorado counties, including Broerman's. That's a big accusation.
But the Election Integrity Group hasn't provided details for these supposed crimes or the affidavits referenced in its report. When we visited his office, Broerman pulled out a map of his county and a highlighter to show us some of the neighborhoods he's guessing they visited.
This is, I think, the precinct, the Fillmore area, where we think there was canvassing done.
He said the group owes it to its volunteers to share whatever evidence they have. Broerman is basically certain there's a reasonable explanation for whatever anomalies the canvassers think they found.
I think the volunteers that did this really want to gain better understanding and assurances. And I think you owe it to them to follow up on that data and verify that it is indeed the case and it's not being used as a tool to push a particular viewpoint.
But at this point, you may be wondering, is this sort of data collection even legal? Can just anyone go door-to-door asking people about how and whether they voted?
And the answer is pretty complicated.
It's not against the law for constituents to investigate their own elections.
That's Sharona Bishop, who helped organize canvassers in Mesa County.
There is no law against going door-to-door to figure out if people actually voted in the election that the certified data says they voted in.
And Bishop is correct, though, with a giant asterisk. In an open letter last year referencing an election review in Arizona, the U.S. Department of Justice warned that certain canvassing could be voter intimidation, possibly violating the Federal Voting Rights Act.
And some county officials got calls last summer from people who said canvassers claimed to be with the government. Here's Carly Kappas, the Republican county clerk in Weld County.
We started getting calls saying, what in the heck is going on? Like, why did these people come to my door? Why are they asking me about this? And they said they were giving the perception that they were with your office. And if you're giving that perception that you are a government official, it almost equates to the same as you saying that you're a police officer when you're not.
All the canvassers we talked to said that didn't happen on their watch.
In Mesa County, the clerk's office said they answered questions for months. And according to county officials, a lot of the voters were angry at the clerk's office because they said canvassers told them their votes weren't counted. The clerk's office said that information was wrong.
Several voting rights groups have also filed a lawsuit to stop these sorts of canvasses from continuing in Colorado after the midterm elections. They allege it's a type of voter intimidation that will negatively affect communities of color.
And U.S. Election Integrity Plan has countersued for defamation.
Even if the voting rights groups do stop this specific practice, though, election officials say that doesn't solve the core problems that drive people to election denialism. Here's Clerk Brewerman again.
I think people are looking for answers. You know, I voted for candidate X. I voted for issue Y. All my friends that I, you know, live and work with and go to church with and hang out with believe like I do. So how could something be different than hot?
He says for a lot of these volunteers, investigating election results could be part of their search for meaning and understanding in the world. For NPR News, I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
You're probably feeling it, and you're probably talking a lot about it just like we are. It is hot. So hot that the National Weather Service has issued excessive heat warnings and heat advisories for about a third of the country. A colored weather map right now looks like the country is on fire, with the day's high temperatures in red and magenta. Meteorologist Mark Elliott joins us now to talk more about these crazy hot temperatures. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Miles.
So some would say it is July. It is supposed to be hot. But how does this summer compare to, you know, say the average temperatures around this time of year?
Yeah, I hear that a lot, right? Breaking news, it's hot in the summer. But even with that, at least in some cases, this is way on the side of what can be considered a normal or an average heat wave in the summer. If you take some of Oklahoma's readings from yesterday and put all the normal, all the actual temperatures on a curve, right, a bell curve, some of yesterday's temperatures were all the way on the right side of this, a real side of that tail. And that shows us just how extreme some of the readings have been.
Okay, so what's causing this burst of high temperatures? I know climate change probably plays a role in this, but can you talk a little bit about why this is covering so much of the country?
Yeah, you know, there's a background of climate change at this point. There's going to still be summer, just like there's still going to be winter in a warmer world. You'll still have cold during the winter season. You'll still have hot during the summer, but we're loading the deck. We're forcing that hand. And so when you get the right kind of weather setup that could give you some extreme temperatures, we then have a background of climate change behind that. You know, it's tough to say one thing that's causing this heat. There's a real big dome of high pressure. We're in a weird and a weirdly strong La Nina. When you expect to see warm temperatures in the southern plains, but we've had other La Ninas that didn't do this. And so it's not just one factor. It's that combination of weather and big forcing and climate change behind that.
Is there any connection between the heat wave we're seeing right now in the United States and the heat wave that has been kind of crushing Europe? I know we saw record temperatures in the UK yesterday.
Yeah, unbelievable stuff in Western Europe. Not just UK. UK stole the headlines, but UK, Wales, Scotland all saw all-time record high temperatures, which, you know, we saw the reports in Celsius between 35 and a little over 40 C. But for us, that means between 95 and 105 degrees. Remember, the UK is north on the globe than all of the lower 48. Just to see temperatures there at 105 is pretty remarkable. It is connected still potentially with that La Nina impact across the globe, but generally bigger, slower moving high pressure areas are what we would expect in an overall warming world. And both locations are underneath these big heat domes right now.
Okay, Mark, in the 30 seconds I have you here, can you talk a little bit about the coming days and the coming week? What should we be expecting with this heat wave?
Yeah, cooler, but certainly not cold. I think we, across Europe, get back to near average, which will feel really cold from where they were. For the lower 48, we're expecting this heat to continue across the southern plains. The heat advisories and excessive heat warnings will likely be there for a couple more days. The Northeast should get a little bit of a break. They have heat advisories today, but a cold front will come through.
Meteorologist Mark Elliott, keeping an eye on this sweltering heat wave. Always great to talk to you, Mark. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You might not be surprised to hear this finding from a new study. Teachers and principals are dealing with job-related stress at a rate that's twice as high as the stress experienced by other working adults. That stress is creating teacher shortages in many states as more and more educators retire early or change their careers. Suzanne Perez of the Kansas News Service reports.
As principal of Baser Linwood High School near Kansas City, Jared Furman was a rising star. He has two decades in public schools and co-chaired a state task force on graduation requirements. State leaders called him energetic, innovative, an example for other principals. And this summer, he's leaving.
I'm going to go do HR in the corporate world and give it a shot out there.
The past few years have just been too much. Furman would often get to school before the buses at 7 a.m. and not leave until after a basketball game, around 15 hours later. There were days he never saw his wife and kids. And then there was all the hostility over masks or library books or whether the latest history lesson talked too much or too little about race.
It just wears on you. It's just exhausting. And I think I was just tired.
He's got company. Researchers with the RAND Corporation surveyed thousands of teachers and principals this year. They wanted to gauge how teachers around the country were feeling about their jobs 2 years into the COVID pandemic and whether they had considered leaving. Here's what they found.
A picture of stress and job dissatisfaction for many educators.
That's Elizabeth Steiner, RAND's director of research. She says about 3/4 of teachers and 85% of principals experience frequent job-related stress. About 1 in 3 teachers said they were likely to leave their jobs by the end of the school year.
And teachers were more likely than other working adults to say that they were experiencing burnout.
What does that mean for students? When teacher vacancies go up, student achievement goes down. That's because many schools have to cancel courses or cram more kids into a classroom. They rely more heavily on substitutes or teachers who aren't certified in the math or history or science courses they're leading. Teacher morale plummeted over the course of the pandemic. It hasn't rebounded. Students fell behind, and teachers feel pressured to catch them up. They also feel overworked and unappreciated. During a school board meeting in a district near Kansas City last year, veteran teacher Diane O'Brien got emotional as she pleaded for community members to back off the criticisms or risk losing more teachers.
Now's the time for change. Something has to change.
Kansas reported about 1,400 teacher vacancies this spring, nearly double the number 2 years ago. Numbers due in October will almost surely reveal an even worse teacher shortage. The same goes for principals and superintendents. Here's Kansas Education Commissioner Randy Watson.
We are worried that we're going to have an educator shortage that may be the most severe we've ever seen.
The teacher shortage has been building for years, but mostly in specific areas like math, science, and special education. Now it's even hard to find kindergarten teachers. Cindy Deitch recently retired after more than 3 decades teaching kindergarten. She says the second-guessing of teachers started to wear on her.
We're micromanaged a lot, where we're told exactly what we're supposed to be teaching, when we're supposed to be teaching it.
Last year, Deitch had to test every student, every quarter, on more than 20 different reading standards. When she started teaching, it was 4. She says the constant testing made her feel like she wasn't actually teaching.
We weigh the cow and we weigh the cow, but we don't have time to feed the cow because we're weighing the cow so much.
Elizabeth Steiner, the RAND researcher, says school leaders should ask teachers what contributes to their stress and then ask for ideas to fix those problems. Teachers need more breathing room in their schedules, she says, and more control over what happens in the classroom.
If there's anything district and school leaders can do to address the things that teachers find difficult about their job, even though that's not directly a mental health support, it could help improve educators' mental health.
More vacancies could mean larger classes and even more stress on teachers. Kansas leaders are looking at potential solutions, including teacher apprenticeships and team teaching models. For Here and Now, I'm Suzanne Perez.
The film adaptation of the hugely popular novel Where the Crawdads Sing is now playing in theaters. It's the fictional story of a girl left to raise herself along a North Carolina bayou in the 1950s and 60s. Later, she's put on trial for murder.
I had a family once. They called me Kaya.
A little girl surviving in the marsh on her own, reviled and shunned.
As NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports, the novel's author has a mysterious past.
It took wildlife scientist Delia Owens a decade to write Where the Crawdads Sing. It's now been on the New York Times bestseller list for 168 weeks. Here she is on CBS Sunday Morning.
It holds the record for being number one for the most weeks.
And this was your very first novel?
First novel.
Actress Reese Witherspoon loved it so much, she added it to her popular book club and produced the film adaptation.
It just blew me away. It felt like when I was reading To Kill a Mockingbird or just any sort of classic Southern literature. She layers on this thriller element. There's a murder.
And murder, a real-life murder in the mid-1990s, is the big elephant in the room. With the film's release, news has resurfaced that 73-year-old Owens is still wanted for questioning by Zambian authorities as a possible witness, co-conspirator, and accessory to federal crimes. At the time, she and her then-husband Mark were living in Zambia as animal conservationists, trying to save elephants from poachers. Journalist Jeffrey Goldberg first wrote about this for The New Yorker in 2010, and more recently, The Atlantic Magazine, where he's now editor-in-chief. His reporting suggests the Owens set up a brutal operation to go after anyone who was a threat to the elephant reserve. In fact, an ABC News crew documenting the Owens' work in 1995 actually captured the execution of a suspected poacher. Here's a clip with gunshots from the show Turning Point.
The bodies of the poachers are often left where they fall for the animals to eat. Conservation. Morality. Africa.
The shooter of the unidentified man was never seen on camera, a body was never found, and no one has been formally charged with the crime. Some witnesses reportedly implicated Mark Owens and his son Christopher, according to Jeffrey Goldberg, but the journalist says their attorneys have issued statements of denial in the killing. He quoted Delia Owens, saying she had nothing to do with it. For months, the movie's publicists have told me the author is not available to comment, so the news continues to hang over the film like Spanish moss over a murky bayou.
Oh, Carolina knows why for years they've said that I was guilty, yes.
Taylor Swift wrote and sang on the film's soundtrack, saying on Instagram she wanted to create something haunting and ethereal to match this mesmerizing story. But she's faced social media backlash for her involvement in the film. In an interview, the director and star of the movie both told me they don't know anything about Delia Owens' past, though they did say she has a cameo in the film. Instead, they talked up how the isolation and resilience of Where the Crawdads Sing resonated with readers. Director Olivia Newman told me the story is more than a murder mystery.
There's this survivalist tale and this observation of nature, which is so gorgeously articulated by a scientist. There's this epic romance. That was the hope for the movie, was to create that same sort of world that you didn't want to leave.
British actress Daisy Edgar-Jones, who plays Kaya in the film, says she met with Delia Owens when they shot on location in the marshlands around New Orleans.
To actually film in these amazing sort of bayous and marshes with the Spanish moss and the sound of cicadas, and just, it was absolutely magical.
Edgar-Jones says Delia Owens encouraged her to enjoy herself in portraying the main character.
Kaya is a very complex character. You know, she is very sort of strong and resilient, but she's also a very curious and gentle creature, and I think she's complicated like so many of us are.
Early reviews of Where the Crawdads Sing have been mixed, and it remains to be seen whether questions about the author will overshadow the film. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
And a warning to our listeners, we are about to use a lot of very bad puns. That is because our resident chef Kathy Gunst is here, and Miles, I can assure you her recipes are going to be very good.
I gotta tell you, Peter, I am very excited, but this is going to get quite unbearable for our listeners if we don't bring in Kathy soon. So Kathy Gunst, welcome to the show.
It might get unbearable for me as well.
Fair enough. So people probably guessed what we're going to be cooking with today. But before we get to those recipes, I got to ask, I heard that you bought your house because there were actually berries growing there. Is that true?
Well, it is only a small part of the story. We found this old farmhouse in Maine, and when I discovered that the edge of the property was just lined with raspberries and blueberry bushes, it was a done deal.
Yeah. So I don't know if you used any of the, I'm sure you used some of those in the recipes we're going to get today, but why don't we start with the beet and raspberry salad with feta cheese?
Let me begin by saying that I, unlike a lot of people, I'm not a big fan of using berries in savory food. I don't like berry soups or like strawberry salad. Not my thing. But I kept thinking, I woke up one morning and I had these beautiful golden yellow beets. And I thought, what if I roasted those so they get really sweet and earthy, thinly sliced them, sprinkled salty white feta cheese on top, and then I did go out and pick several cups of gorgeous plump raspberries, scattered that on top, and then added nasturtiums and edible flowers, a little olive oil, and balsamic vinegar.
Sorry, what are nasturtiums?
Nasturtiums are edible flowers. They're very beautiful, wow. Orange and red, and they are, the greens are edible, but the flower itself is very peppery and adds a beautiful color and texture. And to the salad, it adds this great pepperiness. And this combination is wildly successful. I am loving this.
Yeah, that sounds beautiful. I'm curious, do the beets have to be roasted, Kathy? It sounds like that might be a key part of this. Or can you use kind of the store-bought, either in a can or sometimes, you know, they have the pre-bought or pre-roasted beets. Would you encourage people to roast their own beets?
I would encourage people very much. I mean, I grew up on canned beets and thought that I hated beets because canned beets have no flavor and they lose all their vitamins and they're extremely mushy. When you roast them yourself, they maintain their shape and their sweetness and develop a very earthy roasted flavor.
Okay, next up, blueberry lemon tea cake.
Yeah, this is fabulous because it is so simple. You make it in a bread loaf pan, and the cake batter is quite simple. It's flavored with lemon zest and lemon juice, and then you mix in lots of fresh blueberries. And yes, you could add blackberries or raspberries. And once the cake is cooled down, you make this very simple glaze from lemon juice and confectioner's sugar. Pour it on top, and you get this gorgeous clear glaze. Grate a little lemon zest on top and surround it with more berries. And we've been eating this for breakfast with strong cups of coffee, for snack, and also for dessert. It's just it's a great cake. I'm thinking of making several and popping them in the freezer for a colder month when I will really love it.
Yeah, the morning cake with a cup of coffee, that cannot be beat. And
exactly.
Kathy, I know you also have a recipe for a raspberry tart with vanilla pastry cream. And I worry that my cooking knowledge and understanding is a little low for this one, but I'm hoping that you can talk me through it.
I know it sounds fancy, but here's the deal. A pastry cream is a matter of heating up some milk and vanilla. You whisk some sugar, cornstarch, and eggs. You whisk it all together. It's like a pudding. You pop it in the refrigerator overnight. You can buy a pastry or make a very simple pastry, a stick of butter, cup and a half of flour. Put that in the refrigerator overnight. And then the next day, you roll out your pastry, you pre-bake it, so you put rice or beans on it so it doesn't puff up. So you're essentially baking the shell without the filling. And then when it's cool, you spread some raspberry jam on the bottom so you get this wonderful berry flavor on the bottom. Then this vanilla pastry cream, and then you go nuts and just coat the top with raspberries, blackberries, blueberries, huckleberries, whatever you've got. And it is, it's one of those desserts that looks so fancy and show-offy, but it's not complex.
And speaking of jams, can you tell us about the jam that you're making in the, in like less than a minute?
Yes, it's boiling raspberries with some sugar and lemon juice. No pectin, cooks for about 20 minutes. The lemon juice helps the natural pectin come out, and it keeps in your fridge for 3 to 4 weeks, or you can process it for 12 minutes and have it for a year, and I'm having it every morning. I just love it.
Oh, you got to love summer. There are so many things to just pluck out of the backyard. Kathy Gunst, hey, there's some of these were on the complicated side. We'll get the recipes up at hereandnow.org just in case people didn't catch all of the details. Kathy Gunst, thank you so much. We really appreciate
it. Thank you both. Great to talk to you.
You too. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Miles Parks in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.